This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Yes, so I'm excited today. I have Nick Croydon, and he is the CEO of QBD Books Australia and brings over 25 years of experience in international publishing and book retail. The Turing Protocol is his debut novel. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get straight in. Set in World War II, the story begins with Alan Turing, the famed Enigma codebreaker, unveiling a remarkable invention, the Nautilus. And it's a machine capable of sending messages into the recent past. Also, fast forward 75 years, Annabelle McIntosh discovers she's the current guardian of Nautilus. So what was your inspiration here? What inspired the Turing Protocol, and how did your background in history and mathematics influence its development?
Good question. I've been interested in history all my life, since I was 6 years old. It was my favourite subject at school. My second favourite was mathematics. So I guess Alan Turing became in my wheelhouse. And then when I started studying about the Enigma code and Alan Turing, I obviously discovered what the British government, how they treated him, which was appalling.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I need to shine a light on this and on him. And so that became the sort of basis of the beginning of an idea. And then, you know, he was such a genius, you know, to the level of, like, you know, Da Vinci and Isaac Newton, you know, super intelligent. And I thought, if he had, you know, lived, you know, he was discussing AI in, you know, 1952. Could it be possible that he builds a machine that could send, you know, a message back in time and in, you know, in Morse? And I thought, well, as a fiction writer, you can just make that up.
Absolutely. So, the beauty of fiction.
Yeah. And so when I did my research, you know, there is a magnetic accelerator in Geneva, a little bit bigger than mine. It's 24 kilometers in circumference. and they do get 99.999% to the speed of light. So to get to that's, for an author, that's close enough to reality.
So I thought that's
not much of a push I need to do. So I made that leap, and then I had my mechanic for the story, which was the machine sending back a message to yourself. Right? Yeah, so the person's not going back in time; it's just a Morse code message. And what you can do with that. So then I could start messing with history and creating pace. So because it can only go back 8 weeks. So that kind of creates drama and pace. And then, you know, when I was writing, and I would just look for more and more ideas that actually existed. So, like, you know, 9/11 is in the story. The Cold War is in the story. You know, the Ukraine War is in the story. And then those became my sort of big chapter moments where I could change the event and have the present guardian try and get it back to the history that we know today.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought those elements up. So the novel weaves together both past and present and engages an alternative history, and it's a speculative suspense. The story ponders the ethical weight of knowing and possibly altering history, weaving pivotal historical events into the narrative. So you mentioned the Soviet Union, the fall of the Soviet Union, 9/11, and also the Cuban Missile Crisis. So how did you navigate this interplay between the historical accuracy and creative storytelling, especially when dealing with figures like Alan Turing? Did that become, how did you navigate that?
So what was interesting is when you're doing your research, is you find sort of, you know, surprising facts. So when I was at Bletchley Park and talking to the curators there, you know, we were discussing how much, you know, I'd seen the movie that they made of the Imitation Game, but I was asking them, like, how real was it that he knew the whereabouts, you know, that Enigma team knew the whereabouts of all the U-boats? And how often did he have to make the decision to let a convoy get attacked? Right? And I thought, what a decision to make, you know, really playing God. right? Yeah. You know, there's going to be an interception from a U-boat, and you can change that. But he chose not to because he would give the game up.
Mm.
Right? So that actually happened. That wasn't fiction. That's real. Yeah. And then I kind of thought, well, how can I expand on that concept to the machine where you're also playing God, right? And you're going to change something. And really ponder the thought process that you'd have to go through if that were you. Mm. And then I thought, well, as readers read this, they will be asking themselves, well, what would I do? And I thought that was a fascinating concept to develop.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It is fascinating, a fascinating concept. And so we begin. The prologue is set in Kiev in March 2022, as you mentioned. What did you want to say in crafting this parallel between this particular historical moment, between this sort of this modern day crisis, if you like, and the history of World War II?
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to look at how fragile the world can be. Mm. We all get on with our lives, and then you wake up one day to a headline, like as we did a few years ago, that the Russians had invaded, right? And people then hold a breath and go, well, are we going to do anything about it or aren't we? Right? And that you then mirror to, an event in 1939 where the Germans invaded Poland, right? And at that point, very quickly, the Europeans did something about it and declared war, right? In those days, it was conventional weaponry, right? So it was a safer thing to do. These days with nuclear weapons, you tread lightly before you declare war against the Russians.
Yeah.
Right? So I thought that was kind of fascinating. That's what I wanted to lead the readers through, is the change in technology and therefore the change in the thought process of our leaders who we entrust, just like with Annabelle, she's entrusted to the machine. We empower our political leaders, who can press buttons and release weapons. Mm. And I wonder how they feel having that power. So, yeah, I just wanted to make the parallels between war then and war today, quite a different thing.
Yeah. Before we hear the prologue, I think you also endow this with, this kind of sense of power, and you're sort of questioning the sense of power that certain individuals have. Obviously, there's a metaphor throughout this as well, this metaphor of the past and the present and how we, struggle as people, people in charge, the abuse of power. Yeah. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I started thinking, again, back in the time of World War II with Oppenheimer.
Mm.
So here we have a brilliant physicist and scientific being. And he was given a project to build, an atom bomb, which I'm sure as a scientist would have been fascinating for him at the time, and a challenge and what he would have lived for to be a pinnacle of his career. But then as he got closer to the success of what he was doing, he would have also realized, well, this is a weapon. This is not a science lab experiment. I'm creating a weapon which I don't really know the power of. Right? They did some testing, but the real test was dropping it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then listening to his opinions after the event of that, and how he kind of regretted what he had done or the consequences of what he had done, and then he realized the enormity of what he had developed, and also I think I say it in the book, the genie was out the box, so he would have known that other nations would copy the technology. And I just wonder again, this is similar to the things we're doing now, even with AI, do we know the consequences
exactly
that's coming?
Yeah, that's right. What I felt as well. There are so many, there's this sense of, history repeating itself.
Yeah.
And, what we're dealing with now with all these conundrums with AI and social media for children and all of that stuff, it's already there in our history. So, yeah, very poignant.
Yeah.
Could I ask you please to read the prologue?
Sure.
Thank you.
Prologue. London, March 11th, 2022. The bomb's massive explosion shook the ground, destroyed electricity substations and ripped apart apartment complexes and hospitals, killing hundreds of Kyiv civilians. The cries of women and children were punctuated by the sound of rapid gunfire as Ukrainian soldiers fought the Russians street by street, house by house, the fallen left dead in their own blood on the desolate streets. Annabelle turned off her TV, unable to watch anymore. She sat in the kitchen of her father's apartment in Paddington, sipping a latte from Harrison's on Spring Street, her customary beverage, even if the rest of the day would be anything but customary. The war was intensifying by the hour. How had life come to this? She had no answer, but she did have access to power, to a singular, godlike technology, unknown to any other person alive, enabling her to alter this war, perhaps end it. But to use it was to break a solemn promise she had made to her father 4 years ago. The power was within Annabelle's reach at all times, but with the use of it, even with good intentions, came great risks and dangerous, unforeseeable consequences. It terrified Annabelle to possess this power and the secret of it, all alone, but to involve anyone else entailed monumental risk, both to her and her family, who guarded the secret since World War II. She paced, thinking, weighing the dangers against her chances of using the device successfully. Could it even be done? It came down to belief. Belief in herself, belief in her own ability to use the power safely, responsibly, not just for her, not just for the family, or even her country, but for all mankind.
Thank you. So you, this is the modern day narrative line, and so that you're playing sort of between two timelines. Was it your retail publishing background that influenced how you structured this book, do you think, or was this just a creative part of your brain?
So a bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked time slip. I think it's very hard to write to. Because you're constantly having to check your timelines,
yeah,
and it's easy to make mistakes. But what I love in reading fiction is I love pace.
Right? Okay.
So, yeah, I love ending on a chapter and sort of automatically required to carry on turning the pages. And I've seen that in my retail life as well, that novels that are pacey thrillers, exciting, you know, do well. So that was a perfect marriage for me.
Okay. And while I have time, and we have this unique opportunity with you being here in the studio, so are you able to speak, you're the CEO of QBD, as I mentioned before. What is the sort of state of the resilience of books and the resilience of the industry at the moment, considering that we have low literacy rates and low sales figures? What's the perspective of the book industry, do you think? What's your perspective?
Yeah, so obviously I've been involved for many, many years in the industry. People have told me the book is dead for the last 25, 30 years.
Okay. Right?
So it is resilient, mm-hmm. Thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly under attack, though.
Yeah.
Right? We're under attack from alternative technologies. We're under attack from retail space, from electronic digital versions. So I'm obviously a big lover of paper printed books.
Mm-hmm.
I do also like audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
As a retailer, obviously I sell mostly printed books. There is a very small decline in this country at the moment on sales, not with us, but the overall market. But that's more to do with economic factors, rents and cost of personnel and margins and print costs, rather than demand.
Mm-hmm.
There is a challenge that we have with keeping reading going with the young generation. You know, they've got too many devices that want to take their time.
Absolutely.
And we fight against that.
And that's our fight.
Yeah, well, as parents and retailers.
yes, exactly. Thank you, Nick Croydon, for being my guest. The book is called The Turing Protocol and it's Affirm Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Lisa. The discovery of a body and the disappearance of a child. And these two events are at the centre of Luke Johnson's debut novel, King Tide. So, Luke, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
Now, we have to tread very carefully as we explore this story for fear of giving things away, because if we say too much, we won't have a reason to read the book. But the body is that of Hayley Rose. Who is she and where was she found?
So Hayley Rose is a character that came to the small town of Lagunas Bay a year or a little bit more prior. And she came with a reputation which spread quickly in the small town and effectively befriended the local golden boy, Tate Moon. And at a period after she was there, she went missing. And as it happens, the police at the time didn't really try too hard to find out what had happened. They put in minimal effort and the town kind of just moved on. So Hayley Rose sort of went off into the ether, but was revealed with The King Tide, which opens the book 3 years after her disappearance.
So, and her body has been relatively well preserved because of, in the dune.
Correct, it has. Yes, right. Yep.
Yeah. Now, we've also have another disappearance of a child some 5 or 6 years earlier, who Ben Moon has disappeared earlier on. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, so Ben is the younger brother of Tate, and hence when the body of Hayley Rose turns up and the local detectives start to investigate early on in their investigation, they find that Tate is a common player between both of these missing young people. Ben was never found. He went to the bush with Tate and two of his best friends a year or two prior, as you say, to Hayley going missing, and his body was never found. So the suspicion falls on Tate from the detectives early on.
Well, in fact, the suspicion falls on this little group of adolescents. There's Tate, but there's also Luther Hillman and Briley McIntyre, and they're sort of the pivotal core of that can put these two events together or give some perspective, shall we say. Let's sort of unravel these characters a little. Luther Hillman, not necessarily the most upstanding citizen, you might say. I mean, here we go. Dunno. Luther took a final drag and stubbed the butt out in the grass. He's always been like that. Guess it's how he was raised, or maybe it's in the blood, you know. When I first heard someone say I was from a broken home, I thought they meant the plaster and cornices and shit that's busted and cracked at my joint. He spat on the ground where the butt lay. I don't know what they mean, the people in it. I can't use, there's a certain word I can't use in there. But yeah, Luther, not the most upstanding.
That's right. So Luther's the bad boy of the group. There's two boys and a girl, Tate and Luther, and Briley McIntyre being the girl. So I wrote Luther. Initially, Luther was there to be the more difficult of the three, the sort of the thorn amongst the two roses, if you like. And he comes from a broken home. He's, you know, he's not the greatest adolescent that would be around. But as I came to write him, and his loyalty to both of his friends became a really big thing for him. In fact, as it turns out, it's really all Luther had to give himself value, apart from perhaps his sort of ferocity and violence.
Well, how's his dad treating him? Where's that ferocity and violence come from?
Well, that's right. Yeah. So I like the idea with all of the stories that I write and the characters in them to consider the effect of DNA versus environment. In Luther's case, he probably drew a negative on both, I guess. Not that you can't be a very good person from a poor home, but Luther, he didn't have a lot going for him in terms of momentum, that's for sure.
And we've got Briley McIntyre, the daughter of the local Anglican vicar, surely an upstanding young lass. What's going on here?
Yeah, so Briley is portrayed, and it could have been a male character, is the point, but Briley being a very good-looking girl, I wanted to sort of paint the picture of her and have readers wonder whether people who are like Briley, whether they knowingly float above the rest of the people, that the path is sort of patted down for them and they're happy to let things fall around them and people clean up their messes, or whether indeed they are, they have their own agency, and whether they are a little bit unawares that, because it's always worked that way, that they're unaware that other people are making allowances for the way that they look, in essence.
And then we'll go more into her background a little later. But of course then we've got Tate Moon. Well, he's sort of the hero of the town in a way because of the football team and such like.
Yeah, so Tate is one of those guys who he's quite good at everything. And, that brings with it some glory in a small town. He's sort of revered and heralded for the things that he does. But it also brings its own pressures. Both other people expect certain things of him at every turn. And I think young people like that, again, male or female, bring a lot of pressures on themselves when they're high achievers in a lot of ways, that internal pressure to keep everything together, whether it be with their family and so on.
Yeah, well, they're adolescents facing a period of change. But then, yes, they've also got their own family backgrounds to deal with. So Luther's father is sort of drunk by 12 o'clock and such like. How do you cope with a father who's part of the clergy that has expectations? Tate's got some interesting background as well, his mother and his grandfather. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, so Tate's mother, Glenys, is suffering from early onset dementia, and so that adds another layer into his story and another pressure that he needs to cope with. And it also adds another level of intrigue for the story, in that her reporting to police, and when we see a few things from her point of view, she's an unreliable witness to a large degree. But there are moments in the story where perhaps what she says, because of her lack of insight into the past and memory, perhaps carries more weight.
And there's a sort of memory of an event with Tate's grandfather, who's sort of in the background here.
Yes, Albert is Glenys' mother, lives with them at their house in Lagunas Bay. So Albert's background was, for a time, an upstanding member of the community, and he still is, but he was a strong member of the church and good friends with Connor McIntyre. But for reasons unbeknownst through most of the book, they had quite an inglorious separation, you might say.
So we're already starting to see one or two lines of suspicion infiltrating through this. And this is where the suspicion develops, because Tate was actually a friend of Hayley's. And so one has to question, and they were quite close, one has to actually question whether Tate is the perpetrator. There are signs of violence on the corpse. So, you know, Luther's background of violence. So each of them, in many ways, start to come under a degree of suspicion. Because are we able to reveal the condition that and what brought about the suspicion on Tate and Hayley's condition?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So Hayley's body was found with a cross carved in her chest, naked otherwise, had been buried in the dunes that the King Tide revealed. It's where the title came from. So the three young protagonists also go to a camp for the summer each year, have done for quite a few years. And Tate is sort of semi-famous for carving things in trees at the camp. One of the symbols he sort of repeatedly carves in trees that they sit on and play around in the camp is the symbol of the cross, the crucifix. So when that comes to the attention of the detectives, it adds further weight to the suspicion.
But what condition was Hayley in? I mean, she'd had basically a pregnancy.
Yeah, that's right. So she'd been assaulted prior to her death, and when the body was autopsied after being revealed, they found that she'd had a pretty rudimentary abortion a few months before her death.
But what was Tate's I won't say involvement, but he actually helped.
Correct. Yeah, so Tate was involved with taking her to procure the abortion. Not at a hospital. It was under the cover of non-medical purposes, I guess. And so he also looked after her in the immediate aftermath of the abortion.
And paid.
Correct.
So is this an act of charity and kindness, or does it bring about this notion of suspicion?
Well, that's for the detectives to find out, David, isn't it?
Basically. So, but again, you know, you've got that conundrum there because, yeah, Tate, on the one hand, seems to be upstanding, but on the other hand, who does that for someone else and takes on that burden?
Very much so.
Unless they are involved. Mm. So we've got that sort of conundrum there. But now, here we go with another layer, because we've got Briley's home life and we've got Connor McIntyre, her father, who's, as I said, is an Anglican vicar, and his wife, Eden, interesting choice of name there, things have not gone well. For him, Eden had been a treasure when they had first met. Dark features, pretty like a starlet, and a woman of faith. And now, when he'd had a few drinks and let himself think about how she had been in those glorious early days, he couldn't push away the sadness, heavy and thick like his mother's blanket, that her death had brought him. Before Eden had got sick, so sick it made his own bones ache, his faith had always been enough. But as he watched her and waited so long and so keenly for his God to help, Connor McIntyre felt the whole new type of normal sweep across him. And as the world grew dark, so too did his spirit. So all of a sudden we get suspicion cast on Connor McIntyre. And there is suspicion associated with the clergy these days.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I went to a Catholic secondary school through my years, and whilst I had a fantastic time, I was familiar with the, you know, the constant insinuations subtly around there. You know, they're an easy target, which Connor declares as suspicion falls upon him through the book. With that type of a thing for Connor, I wanted to explore the, you know, most people have a pivotal point in their life, perhaps where they start to see the world quite differently, and his wife becoming sick and not being saved by their God was the pivotal moment that seems to have changed his outlook on life.
Hmm. So this all brings nearly everybody under suspicion, which is a good thing. That's what you want in a murder mystery, so to speak. But this is where we can also then pivot into this notion of, as you alluded to before, love and beauty, and this notion of Briley being aware of her beauty. She's a sort of a person of emotional interest for Luther, mm-hmm, and Tate, but is she plying her wares, so to speak, or is she unconscious of her effect?
Mm. Yeah, so that's one of the questions. I think the idea of Hayley coming in and Briley being already an interest was to explore that really fine line that particularly teenagers have in their, you know, exploration of self and their role in their peer group, is as to whether this person is a friend or whether they're going to be more than that. And both of the main protagonists, both of the boys, at various times see Hayley with a fairly blurred line. She's a fairly grey zone. And she doesn't always do her best to unblur that line. Her role is to be a centre point of attention, and her difficulty in deciding where she wants that to go. And Hayley coming to town sort of divides the boys and has them, you know, resettle their loyalties, I guess.
Well, resettle the loyalties, who does whom for what, and the sexual awakening is all part of it as well. But it also then raises the question of what you would do for love, as in your perception of love, which I think comes into this book as well.
Well, in many ways, I think, you know, all those main characters at some point in the book have to question themselves over whether they are willing to hold on to a secret to protect a person that is important to them, or whether to reveal that secret for the greater good of the community or of the person that perhaps has suffered because of the secret is a question they've got to ask themselves.
And another theme that then starts to unravel in here, which we've again alluded to with Connor, that notion of faith.
Mm.
And not just the faith of the clergyman, but that of the parishioners as well, and what you would do, say, hide for because of that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, King Tide, really one of the main themes I set out to explore was the idea of an individual's loyalty to friends or family or what have you, and contrast and compare that to perhaps faith as a greater belief system and what people are willing to do for each or both of those to bring it from a community level to a personal level.
And what is justified? What is moral? What is appropriate? All of these sorts of things. Added to that, we have that cross carved into Haley's body. The other thing you've got here are two timelines, and the Luther, Tate and Brierley are central to both the timelines, both the events, but I'm just wondering what happens to the group dynamic over that period of time. Because, in fact, one thing we haven't mentioned is that Connor left for another parish and has actually returned. So Brierley disappeared out of that grouping, has come back. The dynamic has shifted.
Yeah, I think, much like Nick's comment before, to be honest, I think I really love reading things that have more than one timeline. I think it allows a lot of space for the characters to develop without having to describe it, and you can show it when the second time frame or beyond comes back. So letting time do the heavy lifting for character development by segueing between the two time frames is something that I really like to explore. And so in this case, yeah, you're right, Brierley comes back to town with her father, who comes back to the parish once again. And the differences in them as individuals and the differences in them as a group is a really important part of the story.
But you've also then got a backstory, guilt or suspicion or doubt, betrayal. You've got a whole other series of thoughts and impressions in the background, which then is added to the story that's being told. And while we're at it, we haven't got into Sergeant Harper Lewis and Detective Senior Sergeant Dean McCoy. The problem of policing in a small coastal town.
Yeah, so the two main police characters were there to drive the pace of the story and drive the plot. When I'm writing, I like to, in every chapter, try and make sure I'm always thinking to myself that plot is for pace and character is for connection for the readers. The characters in the story are always the most important to me as a reader, but of course in a crime or a semi-crime novel like King Tide, you need a pace there. You need people to want to keep reading each chapter and to sort of try and figure out what's going to happen. So the two detectives drive that pace, and they've got a funny relationship, Dean McCoy being the older, more senior of the two, but Harper Lewis, who this story, when it comes to the police procedural aspect, is told from her point of view only. And she challenges the seniority of McCoy, but in sort of a respectful manner.
But Dean McCoy's also got one or two problems of his own.
He does. He's not your typical burnt-out cop, but he certainly has a history and a lifetime of baggage to a degree that informs the way he approaches the various classes of people that appear in King Tide.
Well, hopefully we have avoided revealing who was responsible for Ben's disappearance and Haley's death. Hopefully we've actually cast suspicion on everybody, which will mean then that the listener has to go out and find out the truth by reading King Tide by Luke Johnson, and it's from Affirm Press. So, Luke, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me today.
A pleasure. Great to talk to you, Dave.
But there's now one mystery we actually have solved, that which began our program. Where's Jan? And we've found her. And, Jan, you forgot.
I did. I was still on holiday, I think.
But you were the one that reminded us to get in early. But, Jan, you're here and you have your guest. Would you like to?
I would. Look, I've got a bit of mystery here, a bit of history, sort of. But we're starting with a little war history this morning. The first major military campaign fought in the air was the Battle of Britain back in 1940. The Royal Air Force, the RAF, successfully defended the United Kingdom against large-scale attacks by the German Luftwaffe. But the RAF fighter pilots came from different countries. Anne Vine's book, Flight, has a little war history, but a lot more about Melbourne in the 1940s. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you, Jen. Hello.
To our very crowded studio, which is just fantastic. So, how was Captain Peter Stevens involved in the Battle of Britain, and what is he doing in Melbourne?
Well, Captain Peter Stevens, my character in Flight, is an American who comes from a very unprotected background and works his way through to free flying lessons and then free flying training in Canada, as many people did, and then gets himself over to the RAF. His abilities are such that he becomes a fighter pilot, and indeed he gets to the level of ace in the Battle of Britain. The Battle of Britain, September 1940, huge numbers of flights these people did. It was really quite extraordinary, and they were in Spitfires and mostly, or if they were lucky. And I've seen Spitfires actually flown in England by expert pilots doing their stunts and their loops, and it's quite wonderful. So I've always had this great interest in the Battle of Britain and the fighter pilots. My character, who I was working on for a long time, joins in the Battle of Britain and becomes quite famous as one of the top aces. How he comes to Melbourne is because really Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, and he's American, and he feels he really should join in with his own men. He can't just stay in Britain and do the work there. So he joins the Army Air Force, as it was at that time, and he is snapped up by the press corps of the Supreme Commander and made into a kind of showpiece, and comes to Melbourne. He knows that's what he's going to do for a while. He's dying to get back into flying, which is what he loves, but he's in Melbourne and he's there to really, I suppose, create interest and confidence in the Americans as they are going to take over, to a large extent, the war effort.
Well, we've got the American Allied Supreme Commander General Maddox, and I think he might have been based a little bit on General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, but he's very keen to draw Peter Evans into all the publicity he can. And Peter had Clark Gable looks, and his friend Hube has given him a little polish. Why did he need it?
Yes. Well, as I said, he was from a very unprotected background, having been an orphan who survives a lot of trauma. And so when he gets to the RAF, he's very, very good at the fighting, but not perhaps as good at the socialising. But his friend in the RAF is Hube, who's actually Lord Hubert. Hube gets Peter straight away. He realises this is a strong fighter. This is a man like him. This is a man who hates and who kills and who just does it straight away with no stopping. And so they become a very, very firm friendship. I have actually written a novella about that part of the story, which is a sort of adjunct to Flight. But in Flight, we just learn about Hube a little bit from Peter's reminiscences. And Hube has taught him a whole lot of things. In fact, towards the end of the book, Peter remembers Hube saying, "Now that you've got the hang of fish knives and cake forks, there's no stopping you, Pete. Anything you do, people will think is American and modern."
Well, Peter never had to worry about attracting dames. In fact, he already had Iris, and he describes her. She was a stunner, red gold hair, fine long legs, lively face. Where was Iris working?
Iris was working as a dancer at the Tivoli in Bourke Street. The Tivoli was a burlesque and music theatre and comedy theatre, a live one in Bourke Street. It's long gone, unfortunately, but I did go there once and I was pretty young. I was pretty lucky to get there. My parents, like Faye's, were a little bit disapproving of the kind of acts that were at the Tivoli. The Tivoli had what were called the, I think they were called the statues. They were nude girls with perhaps a tiny bit of gossamer somewhere. maybe the G-string area or whatever, but not much else. And they were allowed to present like that if they didn't move. So it was a tableau of these stunning, beautiful women. And that was one of the things about the Tivoli. But the Tivoli also had wonderful shows and very good comedians, Mo Mackacky, the famous Mo Mackacky, and other people, and also famous singers who came out from America and England.
Well, in contrast to Tivoli, we have the Windsor Hotel, and this is where the story starts at afternoon tea. What type of clientele did this place usually attract?
The Windsor was very much the hotel that the richer groups of Melbourne and Victorian society would visit. Certainly people from the country would stay there and go there, and also people from the better, so-called better suburbs or the more affluent suburbs, Toorak, etc., would perhaps have lunch or afternoon tea or high tea at the Windsor. It's still there, of course, and many people in Melbourne go there for afternoon tea or special occasions and
so on. And it was here that the Beauregard sisters, Faye and Edith, their father is Sir Henry, a judge and governor deputy, and their mother, Lady B, has very much a social agenda for her daughters and is delighted with Faye's fiancé, Clive Wilson. Why is he so well thought of?
Well, he's well thought of by Faye's mother and by, I suppose, the general society, because he's the heir to a great deal of land and a great deal of money in Victoria. He, his parents own houses in Toorak, houses in the country, lots of land, and huge incomes from agricultural produce, as people had at that time. So he's what you'd call squatocracy, and that sort of person was considered to be the top pick for upper class girls like Faye. And Faye has drifted into this in a slightly innocent fashion.
She was certainly not instantly attracted to him. And much to Clive's humiliation, he had to propose more than once. So this is a little bit from the book.
Yes, I'll read a little piece. As he proposed again, I silently awarded him marks. Better tone, Clive. Better facial expressions. Nicer smile. Marginally better words, but still not romantic. Was I expected to take him seriously just because he was trying harder? I wondered who had helped him. Would he ask anyone?
So three times, finally she agreed. So we go back to the Windsor Hotel where the book started. What happened there? There were eyes that met.
Faye certainly, well, Peter notices Faye as she walks in. Faye notices Peter because he's in one of her favourite alcove window seats. And they do look at each other. And as Peter says, they begin this game of glancing. And he wants to talk to her, but he's really a bit unsure about how you do that. And he's very frightened that she will just not take any notice. So the first chapter shows things from his point of view. Later, I wrote a chapter in the book that shows it from Faye's point of view. So both of them, in a way, have this instant ignition, but the people around them, of course, are a very disapproving and formal lot, mainly of women, and Faye is extremely aware of this.
Peter does take advantage of chasing her to many places, and especially the governor's ball, and he asks for her to dance. And surprisingly, she says no.
Well, she does say no initially, and she thinks she has every right to, and she's a little bit embarrassed at the idea of dancing with a Yank, as they were calling the Americans. It, at that point, very early in 1942, was seen as a little bit fast and a little bit lower class to be just very accepting of American servicemen's attention. So she's quite restrained, and she wants to, and she also, I think, feels a little bit threatened by this extremely sexy man who's standing right in front of her asking her to dance. And now she's finally right in front of him, in a way, she wants to push him back and assert her own independence.
But he does ignite a spark in her. Her thoughts about romantic love in marriage are maligned by others, though. Her best friend, Peggy, says, "I think your ideas about love are daft." And her mother, "Romance is not the most important thing in a marriage or life." Does she have this spark for Clive?
Well, not at all. And she realises at one point when she looks at two people who are actually making love on a meadow, in a meadow or a paddock, and she looks at the way they are looking at each other and she realises, and it hurts her a great deal, and she realises Clive does not and will not look at her like that.
No. Well, her uncle Eddie calls Clive her flat-footed fiancé. So when she does finally dance with Peter, what's it like?
Well, I enjoyed writing that part. And, it's, you know, if you've seen people dancing in the 40s, people who could really dance, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, of course, you know that it was really quite energetic and beautiful and graceful and lots of lifts and lots of fast-moving dancing as well as close romantic dancing. So I try to move through those things and to use music of the time. I love the music of the 40s and 30s.
They dance to a slow tune, Night and Day, and this it becomes a theme through the story. Mm. But of course, at the end of the dance, Iris turns up. Oh,
now, Iris is no fool. She's a realist too.
Melbourne at this time was still very staid, and Faye's experience was very modest. Religion was very contentious, Catholic and Protestant. Although Faye volunteered at an orphanage, she never questioned the reason for Aboriginal children being there. And with more Americans in town, as you say, society looked down on those women who went out with them, especially with the danger of the brownout strangler. That was true, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. The brownout strangler was a person who killed three women in Melbourne, and it was really, really terribly frightening. For it was quite clear fairly early on that it was an American serviceman who was responsible for these murders.
Mm. Peter is often at the forefront of fighting, and there's the mental problems associated with that. Now, this really comes to light in a conversation, and the conversation is between the American Peter that author Anne's going to read and an older Irish man called Michael that David's going to read, because it really brings home the mental anguish of fighting.
He nodded and cleared his throat. He gave me a quick look and then spoke more quietly. You see a man's head...
That's the Irishman, isn't it?
That's the Irishman.
See a man's head split like a log, running with blood, and you walk past. You blow up a house full of people without your heart skipping a beat.
He turned to me, his eyes dark and tense, complicit. I nodded and breathed out slowly. For the first time, someone was talking about what really happened. I said, "But you gotta keep fighting. It's not like you have a choice." He drained his glass.
You tell yourself, day after day, that you have no choice, that the war is more important than everyone, more important than your brothers, even more important than her. But it isn't.
He took a breath.
We say it's for freedom, and it mostly is. Well, that's the sad part. Freedom is what we're looking for, but all we find is blood. We walk on dead bodies like they're paving stones. We chase our own death.
I wondered how many brothers and friends he had lost. Had his war been longer and more vicious than mine? Had it finished when he walked away? Had that taken courage or been forced upon him? I said, "Dying starts to look like a relief." He nodded.
Folks think fellas like me and you were born for war. But it's just that we've seen worse things than they have. We've learned to do what no one else should have to think about.
I looked away. Yep, they call you a hero when you know you're nothing but a hunter, a slaughterman, a killer.
Aye. Few see that. Fewer admit it.
He met my eyes for a second. I wondered if he had chased death as I did with such excitement.
We do find out what caused Peter to be a hardened fighter. But back to history, Japanese submarines in Sydney Harbour and the fighting over New Guinea. Peter's plane is shot down and he goes missing. This brings two rivals together at St. Francis Church. What were they doing there?
Faye and Iris happened to coincide at St. Francis in the city in Melbourne. Faye has just gone in, after going to a gallery, she's just gone in to say a prayer for Peter. And so has Iris gone in there to pray for Peter. And they meet in the porch.
You've got the feel of the 1940s coming through with women taking what they want to do more seriously. And this tone of the writing may have something to do with your late aunt.
Yes, I was lucky enough to have an aunt who talked to me quite a bit about the war in Melbourne and the 40s and the aftermath of the war as well. She had been a young teenager at the start of the war, and she knew Americans. She went out with groups of Americans in, I think, a pretty respectable and perhaps tamer way than I have drawn in my book. And she had a very friendly family, a friendly mother who would invite the Americans, many of whom were young country boys, home for dinner. And so she had a lot to tell me, but she also told me about the disapproval of Australian men towards women who had any kind of relationship or fun with Americans.
An American war hero with harsh life experiences and a naive Melbourne socialite are such opposites, just as night and day, which is a melodic theme through this book. Set in the 1940s, Flight is a historical romance written by Anne Vines. Good read. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you very much, Jen. And thank you.
Well, there we go, Jen.
Well, thank you very much for your reading too there, David.
Well, you're throwing things at me at the last minute.
Well,
Just hand over a piece of paper and expect me to put on an accent? I don't know.
Why did I expect that? Oh, my goodness.
It's called
my
acting.
Goodness.
Overacting.
Yes, it was sort of the mental anguish I wanted to get through because it was fighting. Okay, well.
There we are.
How are you going to segue all of these books together?
I really have no idea. We've got publishing and such. Like, Luke, it's your first novel, wasn't it?
Correct, that's right.
Debut novel. How did that go in terms of how long did it take? What was the process?
So I wrote it over sort of 8 to 10 months. It was acquired a year ago by a firm and was edited the sort of 6 months beyond that. So it's been a fairly smooth process, to be honest. The editing was a challenge at times. It was new to me, but I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure it's made me a better writer for doing so.
And, well, we've got somebody here from the publishing industry. What do you put writers through with all the editing?
Yeah, I've employed people that have done it. I'm not an editor myself. I also went through it as an author for the first time myself and suffered like Luke did. I was quite appalled when they suggested my 22 pages on D-Day was slightly too much.
I agree.
So I think they gave me two and all my Panzer divisions had to vanish. But it was an enjoyable experience. I think it's, as you say, Luke, You get better at it. You know, I've started work on the second book and I think I've learned a lot from the process.
Well, and turning a novel into a novella, well, having a novella behind it as well. Stories lead into stories and such.
Yes, well, that's right. I, in fact, wrote Flight with a different name as a much, much longer book. And then I saw in a way it was two stories. One story was Peter's background and his struggle to get out of where he found himself. And the second story, which in a way was a bigger story, was the one between Faye and Peter and the whole questioning of what love can do for people who are such contrasts and...
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.